So, good morning everybody. Welcome to the last lecture on compact star physics. So finally we will discuss again what is tidal deformability for neutron stars. This was a term, or is a terminology, which was basically not present in the field 10 years ago. Tidal deformability for neutron stars, 10 years ago nobody knew about it. Maybe a few very selected persons. So nowadays, everybody's talking about tidal deformabilities in connection with the gravitational wave event 170817. So, and this will also be not the last lecture, but also the first lecture where you get a hands-on experience. So I brought you to neutron stars to explain you the concept of tidal deformabilities. So, let's see. How are you doing? Good. So, let's recap what we did. So, we discussed gravitational waves as solution of the linearized equations of Einstein. And then we discussed that we have gravitational wave emission from two orbiting neutron stars shortly before they merge, which has been measured by LIGO and Virgo. And we continue doing that by looking now at corrections from the deformation of the two neutron stars when they're getting close to each other, so they will not be in a spherical shape anymore. They will be attracted to each other and will have this nose shape pattern shortly before they merge. Yeah, and that's exactly what is tidal deformability, a concept which has been introduced by a guy named Love in 1909. And therefore, the key quantity to compute is the Love number. So let's compute some Love numbers. So how are we going to do this? We're looking at the metric, at the perturbed metric. Yeah, so let's continue. Before I start, any questions about the last lectures? No, good. Yeah, so we have now perturbation from the external gravitational field of the companion star, so we have some external quadrupolar deformation of space-time, which gives the perturbation then of the total space-time, which is also experienced by your neutron star. So we have the full metric is basically what was the background metric plus the perturbation each minute. Yeah. So this is basically the metric we already have there from the two neutron stars if they are point particles. Yeah, and this is the correction from gravitational waves. So h mu nu. So perturbation in linear theory of GR. So ansatz, of course we have a multipole expansion of the mass distribution and we have the quadrupolar field, so it's natural to do a perturbation in spherical harmonics. Spherical harmonics, YLM, and we can always expect that basically we have a quadrupole, so L is equal to this will be the interesting spherical perturbation. Yeah. So we write the perturbation in the following form. So we have H mu nu is given by a diagonal form of e to minus alpha of r. That's the metric function we already have seen for deriving the Schwarzschild metric or the Schwarzschild solution for the Toff equation. Then we have the perturbation, which we denote as an additional function h0 of r. We have again the metric function for the unperturbed state, e to beta of r. which basically later on is related to the mass function. And we introduce here a second radial function. And then we have another radial function for the angular coordinates. So this is r squared, k of r. And we have an r squared sine squared theta, also of k of r, times this perturbation in the spherical harmonics with L equal 2 and m equal 0, theta and phi. Do I have phi here? Yeah. And of course, we have the same functions here for both angles as we're looking for spherical symmetric perturbations. Yeah. All the dependence on the angular coordinates is already included here in the spherical harmonics, so we have basically no change in these two functions here. It's the same function. So we also have a perturbation now of the tensor, inertial momentum tensor. Yeah, so we have delta t 0, 0, which is a minus delta epsilon y to 0, theta and phi. And we have another one. This is the energy density, right? So we have a delta t in the II components. This is a delta p. Y to 0, theta and phi. Yeah? Good. And the ansatz we're doing for these perturbations is that this delta, the perturbation in the pressure, is given by the derivative of the pressure with respect to the energy density times the perturbation in the energy density epsilon. Yeah. And dp over d epsilon at t equals 0 or constant entropy is just the speed of sound squared. So this is the speed of sound squared times delta epsilon. Yeah. This is basically now also that we argue that the perturbation somehow enters according to the slope of the equation of state or the speed of sound. Okay. Good. So we plug everything in. So the equation for the perturbed Einstein equation is delta G mu nu is 8 pi G delta T mu nu. Yeah. So all the other components here, when we don't have any perturbation, that includes also here these functions here are assumed to be separated and fulfill the background equation of motion and the background Einstein equation. So if you plug this in, so here we have the ansatz, yeah, for the left hand and the right hand side, you find that the Einstein equation gives the following solutions, that minus h2 of r turns out to be just h0 of r, and that we denote as h of r. So there's a common function which describes the perturbation in the space-like coordinates and in the radial coordinate, in the time-like and space-like coordinates, so in t and r, so to say. And one finds in addition that the derivative of k of r with respect to r is h prime of r plus 2h of r times alpha prime of r. Yeah. So basically, there's only one unique function as soon as we know h of r, and the metric function from the solution of the Toff equation we have to do separately, right? This is the background metric. Then we also know K of R. So we just need to have this function here. So one writes down now, one looks at the remaining differential equation for this radial perturbation and finds some lengthy expression for the differential equation. It turns out that it's quite easy to introduce the following quantity, a dimensionless quantity. So one introduces the quantity y of r, which is defined as r h prime of r divided by h of r. Okay, and for this quantity y of r, one finds the differential equation which looks like this, r y prime of r plus y of r squared plus y of r e to beta of r. P minus epsilon. So here the equation of state enters and the metric function enters as the solution of the Toff equation. Plus a term which goes like r squared minus 6 over r squared e to beta of r. So here the other metric, not just beta of r, enters. Alpha comes later. Plus 4 pi g e to beta of r, 5 epsilon plus 9 p minus 9 plus epsilon plus p over cs squared. So here now the speed of sound enters in addition to the equation of state. Minus alpha prime of r squared, capital brackets, is equal 0. Okay. So let's recap what you have to do. So you look at a neutron star in equilibrium, unperturbed. You solve the Toff equation. For the Toff equation, you get beta of r and alpha of r. In the same time, you solve also now to perturbate this differential equation by using these radial functions. You get a perturbation y of r. With y of r, you can compute then h of r. And then we know the whole radial perturbation inside a neutron star. To first order. Pardon me? 5 epsilon. This is the energy density. Good. We need boundary conditions. We need to discuss boundary conditions. So generically, h of r goes like a constant times r squared plus higher order terms for r equals 0. And for large values, we have to match the solution to the asymptotic solution. So for r goes to infinity, match to the asymptotic solution. And the asymptotic solution is exactly the solution we have given before. This is the external perturbation. And this gives exactly now the Love number K2 by matching to this outside solution. Just to remind you that the outside solution PGO0 is minus 1 plus 2 phi is equal to minus 1 plus 2 G M over R. minus the perturbation epsilon ij. This is now the perturbation tensor xi xj times 1 plus k2 of capital R over small r to the fifth power, where capital R is the radius of the neutron star. And of course, the radius of the neutron star we get from the solution of the Toff equation. Yeah. So by matching to this solution, we get now k2 into the game as part of the boundary condition for r goes to infinity. Okay? Good. Now this matching has a subtlety. So let's look at the profile we have for ordinary quark stars. So we have some metric, we have some function, say y of r. Yeah. Y of r, I have to write down how y of r goes. Y of r is 2, actually, from the boundary condition. This comes from the fact that h goes like r squared. Yeah. So h prime r over h, of course, then goes like 2. It gives 2. Yeah. 2r times r, r squared divided by r squared gives a 2. So the boundary condition for r equals 0 is 2. And then it goes to the asymptotics, like this. Let's write it like this. And then we have the boundary condition here. It matches into smoothly. Okay? So this is inside, and this is outside. Now a problem occurs if we have actually a pressure which is non-vanishing. This is just a sketchy view, right? But if that would be a neutron star. Now for a quark star, we have a jump in the energy density here. Yeah. And a jump in the energy density somehow means also we have a jump there in our metric function, actually. So for a quark star, the whole thing looks like this. And it ends here. And there will be a mismatch here. Yeah, and this mismatch here is for the case when epsilon at the surface is not vanishing. Epsilon at r is not equal to 0. And then one has to use a correction. And the correction is that the y at the surface needs a correction factor. So it goes like r, h prime of r divided by h of r minus 4 epsilon r cubed. And this is the energy density at r over m. Okay. So if the energy density at the surface goes to 0, as we have it for ordinary neutron stars, everything goes to 0, everything is fine. But as soon as we have this jump in energy density, we need to take this into account for the boundary condition when we smoothly extrapolate, yeah, that there's a jump. This correction factor actually comes from this non-monotonous behavior, singular behavior, by looking at the differential equation and realizing that basically what is happening is that we have here a singularity coming from the speed of sound. Yeah. Of course, if you have a jump in energy density, the speed of sound is somehow ill-defined. We get zero here. So this blows up, and the singular term has to be taken into account. Yeah. So this is the mathematical reason that we need to add this correction term. But it's only important for self-bound stars, not for neutron stars. Okay, so as a side remark. Good, so now we can write down k2 as a function of the parameters we have at yr. And it turns out the whole thing depends on only one parameter, and that's the compactness of the star. So a solution is then k2 depends on y capital index r at the surface, and it depends on the compactness, which is gm over r. Yeah. So how does it look like? Yeah, we have time. I can write it down. K2, it's ugly. 8c to the fifth power divided by 5, 1 minus 2c squared, 2 plus 2 cyr minus 1 minus yr times 2c 6 minus 3yr plus 3c 5yr minus 8 plus 4c cubed times 13 minus 11yr plus compactness c 3yr minus 2 plus 2c squared 1 plus yr plus 3 times 1 minus 2c squared 2 minus yr 2c yr minus 1 times the logarithm 1 minus 2c to the power of minus 1. Good. So you see it's lengthy, and but there are straightforward methods to compute this. I mean, there are algebraic tools to do this, but this only emerges as a solution of this one by matching now the solution we get here to this outside solution. It's getting ugly. Yeah. The important thing to see here, despite the thing that it's ugly, is that there's some interesting thing happening if the compactness is actually a half. So somehow K2 is zero. So K2 for a compactness of a half is zero. Yeah, also this somehow, we get some trouble here. So we are in trouble here. So why is the compactness equal to half such a special case? Did we miss something? No? It's the correct result, right?
It's just a black hole.
It's a black hole. So the black hole has K2 is equal to zero. So the other thing you see that is the dominant prefactor. These are all a constant plus some other powers of C which go in linear powers. Here we have a C squared, but all the overall power the whole thing goes is a compactness to the fifth power. K2 otherwise is proportional to the compactness to the fifth power, so for otherwise. Yeah. Note that this applies to any equation of state. We haven't specified the microphysics yet. So the microphysics is in the YR. So this is here in this correction. You see, the dominant factors are compactness to the fifth power, and then there are some small corrections. So you really have to be careful when computing everything. There will be only small changes when you change the equation of state. This applies also for boson stars, fermion stars, dark matter stars, neutralino stars, whatever stars you want to think about, which can be described by the Tolman Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation. The same formula applies within GR. Good, so we can consider also the Newtonian limit. The Newtonian limit is provided by putting the compactness to be zero, putting the pressure to be much, much smaller than the energy density. Cs squared is then much, much smaller than 1. And another one is that G epsilon r squared is also much smaller than 1. That basically means we have really non-relativistic matter. This is what is behind these last two equations, last three ones. So then one finds the following differential equation. The differential equation breaks down to ry prime of r plus y of r squared plus y of r minus 6 plus 4 pi r squared epsilon over cs squared is equal 0. Yeah. Most of the terms drop down. The only term which enters, surprisingly, is just the one which goes like 1 over the speed of sound squared. And of course, this comes from our assumption that we say that the speed of sound squared is much smaller than 1. So this is then basically the dominant term and the only one in the Newtonian limit. Yeah. We can also write down the solution for K2. How does K2 like in Newton? K2 Newton. And the solution is, it's a half times 2 minus yr, yr plus 3. Very simple. Yeah. You see that if yr is 2, this is just the boundary condition. So if there basically is, if it basically means capital R is 0, so there's no matter around at all, so the K2 is 0. Yeah, this comes from the boundary condition, basically. So there are analytically known solutions. So, for example, if we have a polytrope and put n equals 0, n equals 1, yeah, one finds that that y of r is minus 1 in one case, and the other case it's 0.29. So we get values of K2 which are typically at 3 over 4 or 0.26. So let's put down these numbers so that I have a feeling for those numbers. Solution for polytropes. So we put n equals 0, then y of r turns out to be minus 1, and k2 Newton is 3 over 4. Yeah. So this is an incompressible fluid, so if it's incompressible, then we start at 3 over 4. If n is equal 1, this would be an interaction-dominated equation of state. Then yr is equal pi squared minus 9 over 3. This is around 2.26, I'm sorry, 290, and k2 Newton is equal 15 minus pi squared over 2 pi squared, and this is around 0.260. Yeah. So we can look at K2 for planets, actually, to have a feeling about how large K2 is, the Love number. So this applies for planets, yeah, the Newtonian limit. We can take this for planets. So this is what Love did in 1909. So let's look at the Love number of planets. So I have a small table in my script. So we have a planet. And we have K2, dimensionless. So we have mercury. This has 0.45. I omit the error bar. Then we have Venus. This is 0.295. This is the moon, has 0.024. So this is particularly small. Then we have Mars, which has 0.173. And we have Saturn. I'm running out here. We have Saturn with 0.390. And the last but not least, we have Titan with 0.589. So Titan is particularly interesting because it gives such a large love number. Moon is interesting because it gives such a small love number. So it tells you actually something about the composition of those planets. So for example, for Titan, we know that there's some liquid on the surface. Yeah? So this is actually turns out to be, if K2 is large, it's the tidal deformability will be also large. Yeah? So it can be squeezed and squished together. Yeah? If there is some interior which is behaving differently, and this is the case actually for the moon, then this is small. And it does not deform that easy. Yeah, this is what it says. K2 is small, so it doesn't deform easily. K2 is large, it deforms easily. So why is such a stuff as water, which is an incompressible fluid basically, has such a large love number? You see that also in the solution, that if you look at the love number of an incompressible fluid, it's 0.75. It's huge. Yeah, this is basically also the maximum. Incompressible fluid gives the maximum K2, not a minimum. You say, okay, if it's hardly compressible, incompressible, how can you have then such a large tidal deformability? And now comes the hand-on experience. So I have two planets or two neutron stars, and they have now a different equation of state. So this one is hard, a hard ball. This is a soft one. Yeah. And now we compare what's happening if we press it with the tidal, with the gravitational field. Let's start with the soft one. If I have the soft one and squeeze it, it will just increase the interior. If you hold back and absorb the tidal, it will absorb the distortion of space-time. It will just give in. And there's no additional perturbation coming from the softness of the matter. So actually, K2 is small. Small tidal deformability. Okay, understood. Now comes the hard stuff here. What is happening with the hard stuff? If I squeeze it, you see? It cannot increase the interior density. So what is happening? It changes its shape. Yeah? This is not changing the shape, but this is changing the shape. Do you see? Therefore, a soft equation of state, soft material, has a low tidal deformability, and hard stuff has a high tidal deformability. If you don't believe me, you can do a hands-on experience yourself. I leave it to you to squeeze those balls and confirm yourself that the hard stuff really gives away. I was explaining that to one of my students with tomatoes. If you squish tomatoes, what is happening? I mean, the juice is coming out and spreading all over the place, or a whole mess, so the tidal deformability is large. I didn't give him a tomato to try it out. So any questions about the tidal deformability?
Did you try it out with different kinds of tomatoes?
No. No, we didn't use any tomato at all. So, results. Of course, we we can use now different equation of state and calculate now different tidally formed entities, so K2, and then we can compare with the measurement of LIGO. Yeah, and that's what we're doing now in the last minutes. So, the best way to plot actually the Love number is in dimensionless quantity. So we plot K2 as a function of compactness for different equations of state. So we had the polytropes. So this goes up to 0.3, 0.1, 0.2, 0.3. We have seen this is the range of typical compactness for a neutron star equation of states and also for quark equation of states. And K2 can go up to 0.75. It turns out that K2 is actually, for realistic equations of state, quite small. So the values we get at max is 0.15 or so. So, and then we have the curves, 0.15, 0.1 here. 0.2, 0.5 here. So the curves look like this, basically, and then go off like this. So you get different curves depending on the equation of state, but more or less they occupy a band along here where we find a bunch of equations of state. Yeah. So equation of states used. Then we have polytropes. Here. This is the polytrope for n equals 0. It sets somehow a limit to the right. There shouldn't be something to the left, to the right of this line. That's the incompressible limit. And n equals 1 somehow looks like this. Can I have some color chalk? Yes, I do. And then we have a strange quark matter. This is in here. Quark stars. Yeah, these are self-bound stars using the MIT back model. They're basically this is the equation of state we are using. Yeah. Minus a vacuum state. You can say it's a quark star, you can also say it's a self-bound star which has that equation of state. Okay, so what we see, quark stars are somehow stiff, so they have a high K2, a high tidally formability. Ordinary neutron stars are somehow lying close to the limit for a polytrope of n equal 1. Somehow this can serve as a lower bound on K2 for a given compactness. That's what we're using now. Yeah, we discussed before that this tidally formability gives a phase shift of the gravitational wave signal. So from that, you can infer then the parameter lambda from observations. So so LIGO measurement of the tidally formability And the tidal deformability from the measurement from the phase shift is called lambda. And we have the average over the two masses. We get a lambda bar, which is 1 over 26. And maybe I'll just write it already in... No, I'll leave this out. Yeah, no. I just put it in capital lambdas, dimensionless ones. It's easier. Let's skip this step here for the small lambda. So capital lambda is the quantity also usually quoted. So we have an average one, which is then 16 over 13. M1 plus 12 M2. M1 to the fourth power, lambda 1. And the same here now by changing 1 with 2. And it goes as M1 plus M2 to the fifth power, because it is defined actually, the lambda bar was defined as the small lambda bar, which we see in the phase shift, divided by G times the total mass, M1 plus M2 to the fifth power. Yeah. And there you see what we basically do is we're taking out this compactness for the fifth power here, which appears here, and which appears also in the expression for K2 up there. Oh, for the expression of K2, which I just erased. For the expression of K2. So one can cast this whole thing in the form that we have. So let's assume that M1 is equal, M2 is equal M. And we assume also that we have equal radii. This would not be the case for neutron star twins, yeah? But now we assume we have one unique equation of state and no twins. Then, of course, lambda 1 is equal to lambda 2. And we have a K2, which depends on the compactness, which is equal 3g lambda over 2r to the fifth power, which then goes like 3 over half lambda bar c to the fifth power. Yeah. So you see how the compactness cancels out. And now we can derive an equation by equating, by looking at this radius here we have here, r to the fifth power, and relating the small lambda to K2. We get actually a limit on the radius whenever we get somehow a limit on K2, yep, for known measurement. So we measure lambda, we determine K2 from the equation of state, we get the limit on the radius. Yep. So this one here is equation of state. This one here is LIGO. And this one is here basically the result. Yeah. We get actually, if we get the lower limit here, we get actually upper limit here. So this bodes well with the fact that we get actually an upper limit on the radius. So we can recast that equation. And we get that r must be smaller or equal about 13 kilometers, if you do the calculation. To be more precise, I figured it is 13.6 kilometers for a measurement of the tidal deformability of 720. That's exactly the limit given by LIGO. This goes like the power of 1 over 5. And then it depends on K2 on the power of 1/5, and I assume a total mass of 1.37 solar masses, and this goes in linear power with the mass. Okay. This is the total mass. This is the mass measured, basically half of the total mass, the average mass. This K2 actually is K2 I took for n equal 1, and a compactness which is about 0.15. This is this value here, which is a lower limit for the given compactness. If you do the checkup, then if you assume that radius and that mass, the compactness is in fact something like 0.15, yeah, which gives here 0.0776. Good. So this is the radius limit of LIGO, easily explained. There have been calculations also done here at this institute where one used millions, actually billions of equations of state and compute the tidal deformability and check for the radius, and basically a similar result came out. So the radius must be smaller than 13.2 kilometers, yeah, for a lambda bar of 720. Yeah. So by that we can constrain the equation of state, the mass radius relation of neutron stars, and thereby constrain the equation of state. If we get an upper limit on the radius, we know that an upper limit means that the very stiff ones are ruled out, because the very stiff ones withhold gravity, they can be large, and the softer ones are small, squeezed together. So this limit favors soft equations of state, and hard equations of state are ruled out by the measurement of LIGO.
I have a question.
Yeah,
Where does lambda 1 came from?
This comes from the phase shift analysis. So I didn't write down the formula. So you have a phase shift delta phi, phase shift delta phi, of the gravitational wave, which depends on the parameter lambda, which denotes the difference compared to a black hole merger. And they get a constraint on this value lambda, and this value lambda can be related to to K2 with that formula. Yeah, then you have to do some additional calculation for the phase shift, and then you get out this correlation. Yeah. Good. One word about some historical notes. So this was introduced actually by Hinderer et al., this concept. So the whole concept here, the calculation, the first calculation for neutron stars, and so on. This was done by Tanya Hinderer et al. And I think the plot I have taken is from 2013. Yeah, but it goes, actually, first work goes back to 2008, PhD thesis of Tanya Hinderer on that. Okay, so any more questions? No? Okay, then this concludes the course on compact star physics. So thank you for attending, and thank you for asking questions. And I'm looking forward to maybe see some of you in my future courses again. Thank you. That's it.